Hello and welcome to Naxos Audiobook Preview. Today I want to introduce you to one of the most unusual and amazing audiobooks I think I've ever encountered. Astonishing for its writing, and also for a reading that will tax my poor descriptive powers to the limit. The book in question is The Windupburg Chronicle by the Japanese author Haruki Murakami. Murakami was born in January of 1949 in Kyoto, Japan. After graduating from college, he owned a small jazz bar in Tokyo for a number of years. The story goes that in 1978, he was watching a Japanese League baseball game at Jingu Stadium. At the instant the ball was hit in that game, Murakami was struck by the powerful feeling that he could write a novel. And so he did, starting that very evening. That first novel, Hear the Wind Sing, won him the Gunsu Literature Prize for New Authors, and launched what has become a huge career. He recently won the Frank O'Connor Short Story Award. So what's all the fuss about? Murakami's stories seem to inhabit a strange world where the utterly prosaic and the fantastic live side by side. His descriptive writing is spare and very to the point. Everyday events exactly as you or I might live them, cooking meals, having a cold beer, that kind of thing. Yet a sense of strangeness runs parallel with the commonplace. Strange characters, cats that disappear. Cats are a big theme in this. People in wells meditating, flashbacks, events that might or might not be real, matter-of-factly described, leaving much of the tension implied or lurking below the surface. Reading, or in this case listening to, a Murakami story can be an unsettling experience. It draws one into a slightly off-balance but perfectly clear world populated with characters who we can easily identify with, but whose relationship with each other is sometimes odd. Like much great Japanese literature, The Windupburg Chronicle has themes of eroticism, violence, and fantasy woven in. The eroticism is sometimes very explicit, and the violence, particularly in flashbacks to the Second World War, is sometimes gut-wrenchingly effective. Not a story for the faint of heart or purpose. The entire story takes 21 CDs and runs more than 26 hours in narration. But as one who's listened to every minute, I can say without any doubt that it's a vastly rewarding journey. First of all, there's the Murakami story, engaging, strange, and in the end profoundly beautiful. The other thing is the narration by Rupert Degas. His reading is so utterly convincing that I can't imagine this story presented any other way. I guess that's the ultimate compliment for an audiobook. Over the next 20 minutes, I'll give you a taste of his reading in this podcast, but it's only when you've listened to the entire story that the full range of Degas's talents becomes obvious. Here's the very opening. The book's main character, Toru Okada, is at home, out of work, and cooking spaghetti. It's a perfect 6 minutes of story to introduce Murakami's bland yet very strange world.
When the phone rang, I was in the kitchen, boiling a potful of spaghetti and whistling along to an FM broadcast of the overture to Rossini's The Thieving Magpie, which has to be the perfect music for cooking pasta. I wanted to ignore the phone, not only because the spaghetti was nearly done, but because Claudio Abbado was bringing the London Symphony to its musical climax. Finally, though, I had to give in. It could have been someone with news of a job. I turned down the gas, went to the living room, and picked up the receiver.
10 minutes, please,
said a woman on the other end. I'm good at recognizing people's voices, but this was not one I knew.
Excuse me? To whom do you wish to speak? To you, of course. 10 minutes, please. That's all we need to understand each other.
Her voice was low and soft, but otherwise nondescript.
Understand each other? Each other's feelings.
I leaned over and peeked through the kitchen door. The spaghetti pot was steaming nicely, and Claudio Abbado was still conducting The Thieving Magpie.
Sorry, but you caught me in the middle of cooking spaghetti. Could you call back later? Spaghetti? What are you doing cooking spaghetti at 10:30 in the morning?
That's none of your business, I said. I decide what I eat and when I eat it.
Fair enough. I'll call back.
she said, her voice now flat and expressionless. A slight change in mood can do amazing things to the tone of a person's voice. "Hold on a minute," I said before she could hang up. "If this is some new sales gimmick, you can forget it. I'm out of work. I'm not in the market for anything."
"Don't worry. I know."
"You know? You know what?"
"That you're out of work. I know about that. So go and cook your precious spaghetti."
"Who the hell?" She rang off. Deprived of outlet for my feelings, I stared at the phone in my hand until I remembered the spaghetti. Back in the kitchen, I turned off the gas and poured the contents of the pot into a colander. Thanks to the phone call, the spaghetti was a little softer than al dente, but it had not been dealt a mortal blow. I started eating and thinking. Understand each other. Understand each other's feelings in 10 minutes. What was she talking about? Maybe it was just a hoax call or some new sales pitch. In any case, it had nothing to do with me. After lunch, I went back to my library book on the living room sofa, glancing every now and then at the telephone. What were we supposed to understand about each other in 10 minutes? What can two people understand about each other in 10 minutes? Come to think of it, she seemed awfully sure about those 10 minutes. It was the first thing she came out with, as if 9 minutes would be too short or 11 minutes too long. Like cooking spaghetti al dente. I couldn't read anymore. I decided to iron shirts instead, which is what I always do when I'm upset. It's an old habit. I divide the job into 12 distinct stages, beginning with the collar, outer surface, and ending with the left-hand cuff. The order is invariable, and I count off each stage to myself. Otherwise, it won't come out right. I ironed 3 shirts, checking them for wrinkles and putting them on hangers. Once I'd switched off the iron and put it away with the ironing board in the hall cupboard, my mind felt a good deal clearer. I was on my way to the kitchen for a glass of water when the phone rang again. I hesitated for a second, but decided to answer it. If it was the same woman, I'd tell her I was ironing and hang up. This time it was Kumiko. The wall clock said 11:30. "How are you?" she asked. "Fine," I said, relieved to hear my wife's voice. "What are you doing?" "Just finished ironing." "What's wrong?" There was a note of tension in her voice. She knew what it meant for me to be ironing.
That's the very beginning of Haruki Murakami's The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, read by Rupert Degas. In the simplest sense, this book is a story about discovered self-awareness tied into a complicated love story. That description doesn't begin to cover the many levels on which it operates, but it will have to do. In lieu of more information about the story, I thought I should introduce you to some of the strange cast of characters. You've already heard Toru Okada, his wife Kumiko, and the mysterious telephone woman. Then we have the sisters Malta and Krita Kano, strange and beautiful women who help you deal with the problems in your life. You never call them. They simply know to call when you need help.
I was in the middle of preparing lunch when the phone rang again. I had cut 2 slices of bread, spread them with butter and mustard, filled them with slices of tomato and cheese, set the whole on the chopping board, and I was just about to cut it in half when the bell started ringing. I let the phone ring 3 times and cut the sandwich in half. Then I transferred it to a plate, wiped the knife, and put that in the cutlery drawer before pouring myself a cup of the coffee I had warmed up. Still, the phone went on ringing, maybe 15 times. I gave up and answered it. I would have preferred not to answer, but it might have been Kumiko.
"Hello," said a woman's voice, one I had never heard before. It belonged neither to Kumiko nor to the strange woman who had called me the other day when I was cooking spaghetti. "I wonder if I might possibly be speaking with Mr. Toru Okada?" said the voice, as if its owner were reading a prepared text.
"You are," I said.
"The husband of Kumiko Okada?"
"That's right," I said. "Kumiko Okada is my wife."
"And Mrs. Okada's elder brother is Noboru Wataya?"
"Right again," I said with admirable self-control.
"Noboru Wataya is my wife's elder brother." Sir, my name is Kano.
I waited for her to go on. The sudden mention of Kumiko's elder brother had put me on my guard. With the blunt end of the pencil that lay by the phone, I scratched the back of my neck. 5 seconds or more went by, during which the woman said nothing. No sound of any kind came from the receiver, as if the woman had covered the mouthpiece with her hand and was talking to someone nearby. "Hello?" I said, concerned now.
"Please forgive me, sir," blurted the woman's voice. "In that case, I must ask your permission to call you at a later time."
"Now, wait a minute," I said. "This is..." At that point, she rang off. I stared at the receiver, then put it to my ear again. No doubt about it. The woman had hung up.
That was the entry of Malta Kano into the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. Next, we come to one of my very favorite characters in this book, a teenage girl named Mei Kasuhara. In this cast of odd, slightly dysfunctional characters, she really is a bit of sunshine and humor. Murakami's writing has a great deal of humor in it. Not the slap-your-side variety. It's more sly, something that sidles up to you while the story is going by. This next bit is Mei's first appearance in the book.
"Hey!"
said someone. I snapped my eyes open. Leaning to the side, I stretched to see the gate above the weed tops. It was open. Wide open. Someone had followed me inside. My heart started pounding.
"Hey!"
the someone said again. A woman's voice. She stepped out from behind the statue and started towards me. It was the girl who'd been sunbathing in the yard across the alley. She wore the same light blue Adidas t-shirt and shorts. Again, she walked with a slight limp. The one thing different from before was that she had taken off her sunglasses.
"What are you doing here?"
she asked. "Looking for the cat," I said.
"Are you sure? It doesn't look that way to me. You're just sitting there and whistling with your eyes closed. It'd be hard to find much of anything that way, don't you think?"
I felt myself blushing.
"It doesn't bother me,"
she went on.
"But somebody who doesn't know you might think you were some kind of pervert."
She paused.
"You're not a pervert, are you?"
"Probably not," I said. She approached me and undertook a careful study of the nested lawn chairs, choosing one without too much dirt on it and doing one more close inspection before setting it on the ground and lowering herself into it.
"And your whistling's terrible,"
she said.
"I don't know the tune, but it had no melody at all. You're not gay, are you?"
"Probably not," I said. "Why?"
"Somebody told me gays are lousy whistlers. Is that true?"
"Who knows? It sounds like nonsense."
"Anyway, I don't care even if you are gay or a pervert. By the way, what's your name? I don't know what to call you."
"Toru Okada," I said. She repeated my name to herself several times.
"Not much of a name, is it?"
she said. "Maybe not," I said. "I've always thought it sounded like some pre-war foreign minister. Toru Okada. See?"
"That doesn't mean anything to me. I hate history. It's my worst subject. Anyhow, never mind. Haven't you got a nickname? Something easier than Toru Okada?"
I couldn't recall ever having had a nickname. Not once in my life. Why was that? "No nickname," I said.
"Nothing? Bear? Or frog?"
"Nothing."
"Gosh," she said. "Think of something."
"Wind-up bird," I said.
"Wind-up bird?"
she asked, looking at me with her mouth open.
"What is that?"
"The bird that winds the spring," I said. "Every morning, in the treetops, it winds the world's spring. Greek!" She went on staring at me. I sighed. "It just popped into my head," I said. "And there's more. The bird comes over to my place every day and goes greek in the neighbor's tree, but nobody's ever seen it."
"That's neat, I guess. So anyhow, you'll be Mr. Wind-Up Bird. It's not very easy to say, but it's way better than Toru Okada."
"Thank you very much."
She pulled her feet up into the chair and put her chin on her knees. How about your name? I asked.
Mei Kasahara. May. Like the month of May.
Were you born in May?
Do you have to ask? Can you imagine the confusion if somebody born in June was named May?
So far, I've introduced the main character of this story, Toru Okada, and four different women characters. Kumiko, his wife, Mai Kasahara, the neighbor's teen daughter, Malta Kano, and the mysterious telephone woman. All played by the one narrator, Rupert Degas. It's when the various male characters enter the story that my jaw really dropped. In Degas's hands, or at least his voice, every character's distinct and very powerful. This is the uncle who owns the house Toru Okada lives in.
No bad memories you associate with the place, then?
Nope, none,
said my uncle, after he had thought about it for a moment.
But what's this about all of a sudden?
Nothing much, I said. Kumiko saw a fortune teller the other day and came home with an earful about this house, that it's unlucky, things like that, I lied.
I think it's nonsense, but I promised to ask you about it. What do they call it? House physiognomy? I don't know anything about that stuff, but I've lived in the place, and my impression is that it's okay. It doesn't have any problems. Miyawaki's place is another matter, of course, but you're pretty far away from there.
Another important character in this story is Lieutenant Mamiya. His memory of serving in Manchuria during the Second World War occupies a central place in the novel. History, and their reflection in the current characters, runs throughout this book. History that leaves people uncertain or damaged, or in the case of Lieutenant Mamiya, as a shell of his former person. This is the very beginning of Mamiya's story. Later on in the story, it turns into a horrible and bloody memory that's told with incredible effectiveness. I won't play that part here. It really needs to be heard in the context of the greater story.
I was shipped to Manchuria at the beginning of 1937,
Lieutenant Mamiya began.
I was a brand new second lieutenant then, and they assigned me to the Kwantung Army General Staff in Xingqing. Geography had been my degree in college, so I ended up in the Military Survey Corps, which specialized in map-making. This was ideal for me, because, to be quite honest, the duties I was ordered to perform were among the easiest that anyone could hope for in the army. In addition to this, conditions in Manchuria were relatively peaceful, or at least stable. The recent China incident had moved the theater of military operations from Manchuria into China proper. The China Expeditionary Forces were the ones doing the fighting now, while the Kwantung Army had an easy time of it. True, mopping up operations were still going on against anti-Japanese guerrilla units, but they were confined to the interior, and in general the worst was over. All that the powerful Kwantung Army had to do was police our newly independent puppet state of Manchukuo while keeping an eye on the north. As peaceful as things supposedly were, it was still war, after all, so there were constant maneuvers. I didn't have to participate in those either, fortunately. They took place under terrible conditions. The temperature would drop to 40 or 50 degrees below zero. One false step in maneuvers like that and you could end up dead. Every single time they held such maneuvers, there would be hundreds of men in the hospital with frostbite or sent to a hot spring for treatment. Xinqing was no big city, but it was certainly an exotic foreign place. And if you wanted to have fun there, it provided plenty of opportunities.
Although a large cast of characters populate this novel, I only have time to introduce you to two others. The first one is a very funny character named Mr. Ushikawa. He's a very strange, dirty little man, acting as an agent for Toru Okada's sinister brother-in-law. The novel was written in Japanese, and I have absolutely no idea how Rupert Degas decided what accents to use for each character in English, but they fit perfectly.
Maybe I shouldn't say this to you, Mr. O'Keller, but you're ready to go down. It's a sure thing. It says so in my book, in big black letters about 2 or 3 pages ahead. Toru Okada, ready to fall. It's true. I'm not trying to scare you. I'm a whole lot more accurate in this world than weather forecasts on TV. So all I want to tell you is this. There's a time when things are right for pulling out.
Ushikawa closed his mouth at that point and looked at me. Then he went on.
So let's stop all this sounding each other out, Mr. Okada, and get down to business. Which brings us to the end of a very long introduction. So now I can make you the offer I came here to make.
Ushikawa put both hands on the table. Then he flicked his tongue over his lips.
So let's say, I've just told you that you ought to cut your ties with that land and pull out of the deal. But maybe you can't pull out even if you want to. Maybe you're stuck until you pay off your loan.
Ushikawa cut himself short and gave me a searching look.
If money's a problem, we've got it to give you. If you need 80 million yen, I can bring you 80 million yen in a nice, neat bundle. That's 8,000, 10,000 yen bills. You can pay off whatever you owe and pocket the rest, free and clear. Then it's party time! Hey, what do you say?
Amazing to think that there really is only one person narrating this story. Before I let you ponder the meaning of all this, I want to introduce one final character. The brother-in-law, Noboru Wataya. One of the creepiest characters in this or many other novels. Although he only appears infrequently, his malevolence runs like a dirt-filled stream below the surface of the entire story.
Noboru Wataya pushed his untouched glass of iced tea aside.
We are here to inform you of the situation, he said. I asked Miss Kano to accompany me, thinking it would be better to have a third party present. I don't know who Kumiko's other man is, and I don't know where she is now. Kumiko is grown up. She can do as she pleases. But even if I knew where she was, I certainly wouldn't tell you. She hasn't been in touch with you because she doesn't want to talk to you.
She did want to talk to you, apparently. How much could she have told you? You and she are not very close, as I understand it.
Well, if you and she were so damn close, why did she sleep with another man?
Said Noboru Wataya. Multicano gave a little cough. Noboru Wataya went on.
Kumiko told me she's having a relationship with another man. She said she wants to settle everything once and for all. I advised her to divorce you. She said she would think about it.
Is that all?
I asked.
What else is there?
I just don't get it, I said. I don't believe that Kumiko would go to you with something so important. You're the last person she would consult on such a matter. She would either think it out for herself or speak to me. She must have said something else to you. If she had to talk to you in person, it must have been about something else.
Noboru Wataya allowed the faintest possible smile to play over his lips. A thin, cold smile, like a sliver of a moon hovering in the dawn sky.
This is what they mean by letting the truth slip out,
he said in a soft but clearly audible voice.
All of the excerpts in this podcast come from a complete unabridged reading of Haruki Murakami's novel, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle. It's available on Naxos Audiobooks. The catalog number is NAX41812. I've been trying to decide what makes the story so compelling. I listened to nothing but it on 2 driving trips between Toronto and Montreal, and I couldn't tell you what I passed in scenery, but I can tell you exactly the story. I guess it's the story itself, and the characters. Even at their strangest, they have an emotional core that somehow rings true. It's also the simple and direct language. No Baroque ornamentation or excess. A story shorn of all pretense. And if you listen through the whole story, all 26 hours of it, it is more than anything a love story. Beautifully crafted and superbly told. To go out, here's a bit of the last chapter. Not the very end, that would give it away. Just a simple passage with Toru Okada talking to Mai Kasuhara as they stand by a frozen pond in the crisp winter cold.
I'm so sorry I couldn't show you the duck people, Mr. Windup Bird.
Mai Kasuhara looked truly sorry. She and I were sitting by the pond, looking at its thick cap of ice. It was a big pond, with thousands of little cuts on its surface from skating blades. Mai Kasuhara had taken this Monday morning off work, especially for me. I had intended to visit her on Sunday, but a train accident had made me a day late. Mai Kasuhara had wrapped herself in a fur-lined coat. Her bright blue woolen hat bore a geometrical design in white yarn and was topped with a little pom-pom. She had knitted the hat herself, and she said she would make one just like it for me before next winter. Her cheeks were red, her eyes as bright and clear as the surrounding air, which made me very happy. She was only 17, after all. The potential was there for almost limitless change.
The duck people all moved somewhere else after the pond froze over. I'm sure you would have loved them. Come back in the spring, will you? I'll introduce you.
I smiled. I was wearing a duffel coat that was not quite warm enough, with a scarf wrapped up to my cheeks, and my hands thrust in my pockets. A deep chill ran through the forest. Hard snow coated the ground. My trainers were sliding all over the place. I should have bought some kind of non-slip boots for this trip.
"So you're going to stay here a while longer?"
I asked.
"I think so. I might want to go back to school after enough time has gone by. Or I might not. I don't know. I might just get married. No, not really."
She smiled with a white puff of breath.
"But anyhow, I'll stay for now. I need more time to think. About what I want to do, where I want to go. I want to take time and think about those things."
I nodded. "Maybe that's what you really ought to do," I said.
"Tell me, Mr. Windup Bird, did you think about those kinds of things when you were my age?"
Maybe not. I must have thought about them a little bit, but I really don't remember thinking about things as seriously as you do. I suppose I just thought that if I went on living in the usual way, things would work themselves out all right. But they didn't, did they? Unfortunately.